You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Canada votes. What might a change in government mean? Not just for Canada, but for Canada's place in the world. My guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and James Boyes, will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including NATO commences an epic exercise across Europe and the Mediterranean against a backdrop of proxy conflict in the Middle East. Are the West and Russia really going to rerun the Cold War circa the mid-70s? And if so, how might that pan out? The government of the United Kingdom makes yet another announcement of yet further measures to deter its citizens who wish to enlist with Islamic State's foreign legions. But is there any reason to imagine that these will work any better than the others? And as Chinese President Xi Jinping stows his tray table in preparation for landing at Heathrow this evening, we'll see if we can figure out why the UK is rolling out its very thickest red carpet for a dictator. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24. My guests today are the journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and the author and historian James Boyes, regular Monocle 24 contributors each. Welcome both back to the programme. We are going to start tonight with Canada, the people of which are voting today in a general election. The polls, for what they may be worth, suggest that it will be close, although bookmakers appear thoroughly convinced that Stephen Harper's incumbent Conservative government will be turfed out in favour of the Liberal opposition and a consequent restoration of the House of Trudeau. The question before us now is whether those of us beyond Canada's borders should stay up all night anxiously awaiting the result. Jeffrey, what difference to Canada would a change of government
just
make?
On behalf of the people of Canada, as a Canadian citizen, I just want to file a protest with the Monocle
Ethics Board, maybe?
Yeah, Ethics Board about this kind of sneering mockery of all things Canadian politics.
From Australia.
Thank you.
Our politics is, in fairness, quite eventful and entertaining.
Well, guess what? We
defenestrate one of our own prime ministers every week.
Listen. The emperor is about to be dethroned in Canada. This is a big deal. You know, Canada prides itself in being the peaceable kingdom. It prides itself in being a country of accommodating values, of tolerance. And under Stephen Harper, for the last 10 years, the Conservative prime minister who is about to lose, if the polls are correct, it isn't actually that close. He's going to lose significantly. It may not be a majority government for the Liberals, but they are going to win unless something catastrophically is wrong with the polls. And I don't think it is.
The swath of polled opinion suggests that there may be. I've read very close ones and others suggesting it would be an absolute massacre.
There's about a 7-point margin, but let's not quarrel over that. The point is, Canadians are fed up with Harper. The hardcore conservative, aka the people who you might identify with the Republican right in the U.S., they will always vote, and that constituency exists in that country as it does in every country, including this one. But the vast majority of the middle, the swing voters, the middle of the spectrum Canadians, are just repulsed by the imperial prime ministership of Stephen Harper, who has turned the Canadian constitutional democracy into an American-style presidential democracy by centralizing everything, by muzzling his cabinet ministers, by the prime minister's office, which is what he operates out of, has increased massively in size and in scope. And it's just become all about him and message control. But it's also become about a conservative place in the agenda, about reshaping Canada. He will go. Justin Trudeau, the son of former Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, who I remember from my childhood, is poised to be the next Prime Minister. He's a young guy. He's inexperienced, which is somewhat worrisome. But Canadians seem determined to take a risk with Trudeau because they are fed up with Harper.
James, as Jeffrey sort of suggested there, his country and my country do have a couple of things in common, which Canada and Australia...
Exotic fauna.
Exotic fauna. Countries which take up a lot of space. Space, mm-hmm. with a population proportionately smaller than that. Sure. Both very rich, both very wealthy, but both not necessarily regarded as major power players on the global stage. To the rest of the world, and especially to America, your specialty, how much does a change of government in Ottawa matter?
How dare you say they're not a world power? They've got six F-18 jets in Kuwait. They've got a special forces team in Kurdistan training people in that part of the world in pouring maple syrup.
Wait a minute, and now you're both pouring it on. This is what is the number for the Monaco Ethics Commissioner?
Oh, that's a good question. Anyway, you had a question at some point, didn't
there
you?
Was. Does it matter? Well, I was trying to phrase it a little more delicately than that, but James, does it matter?
Well, I guess ultimately it does. I mean, you know, when you look at the trading relationship between the United States and Canada, for example, the fact that Canada, United States and Mexico obviously make up the NAFTA agreement, you know, you've got a very close, important relationship there. If there's anything that's going to be a break upon that, and by all accounts, you know, there has not been a great relationship between the Obama administration and the current Harper administration. Although, that, to be fair, is hardly a unique situation considering Barack Obama's very, very problematic relationship with many world leaders.
Diffident.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I'm very pleased to hear you say that because, you know, you go back a couple of years and no one was saying anything negative about Obama. And I think he has really failed to develop those sort of very strong working relationships which we've seen previously. But I was interested in Jeffrey's point about how it is that the office of the Canadian Prime Ministership has been centralized, become more presidential, to quote Jeffrey. And it's interesting to see how that very much sort of mirrors what's happening in the United Kingdom. There is a sense to which world leaders are increasingly looking to the US as a sort of a model of leadership, trying to put themselves front and center. And of course, if you've got a prime ministerial system in the United Kingdom, in Australia, in Canada, you know, it's not necessarily always very appropriate. So, you know, it is interesting to see the way in which Justin Trudeau will perhaps, if he gains power, if he decides to relinquish that kind of an imperial presidential role, which clearly his predecessor has taken on.
Let me move the conversation, if I may, in another direction, and that is about something else. I mean, obviously, Canada is not a superpower. It's a middle power and has played historically a very important role as a broker of middle power. Canadians who know their history will know that Lester Pearson, who became prime minister, won a Nobel Prize for mediating the Suez Crisis. And Canada has had this unique ability to mediate between the U.S. and other entities as a kind of, hey, we can talk to both. And that's been completely obliterated under Harper. But there's another value that's really been damaged by Harper, and that is tolerance. Canada is really a beacon of multiculturalism, of coexistence between the French and the English. And it was Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre, who created the Bilingualism and Biculturalism Act, the Official Languages Act, which made Canada officially French and English and securing the place of Quebec, the French-speaking minority in the greater Canadian populace. What Harper did during this campaign is one of the most reprehensible and disgusting things a leader has done in some time. He used Muslim women as a wedge issue to gain votes in a way that was just so craven. The issue of the niqab, the face covering that Orthodox Muslim women wear, he made an issue. The Harper government has been trying to ban it in citizenship ceremonies. Now, there are not a lot of women. To be clear, you see the niqab on the streets here in London much more than you do in Toronto or Montreal. He banned it. The Federal Court of Canada overturned it and said that is against religious freedoms. A woman was sworn in wearing the niqab just a couple of weeks ago. In one of the election debates, he said, I'm going to ban that darn thing, knowing that he would be pandering to a kind of racist, intolerant right. The problem, and the reason it's backfired on him, is that Canada is a country of immigrants. Of course, there is this founding population, you know, beyond after the native Canadians of English and French stock. But the fact is that you've got all these people who are of the other. And what Harper did was say, the other are not welcome. The people who are different are not welcome. And it's really offended Canadians, and it's fascinating. He may have got some conservative votes, but he's turned off a lot of others.
Okay, well, let's look closer to home now at our next story tonight. And this is NATO, which has today launched Trident Juncture, as they're calling it for some reason. The alliance's biggest exercise in more than a decade, involving 40,000 troops deploying over the next 5 weeks to theoretical engagements in various locations across Europe and the Mediterranean. NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Commander Europe, the American General Philip Breedlove, says the manoeuvres, I quote, send a very clear message to any potential aggressor, which is not believed to be a coded warning to Peru. James, this exercise has been 2 years in the planning, which was before, obviously, Russia got any funny ideas about Crimea and Ukraine. Is it possible that we are perhaps over-projecting the significance of it, given the climate we now find ourselves in?
Yeah, I think so. We need to be very, very careful with this. If this is something which had come out of the blue, which was initiated by NATO in direct response to what was happening with regard to the more assertive foreign policy of Vladimir Putin, then I think we would have to be looking at this aghast, effectively. But we need to put this into context. As you rightly pointed out, this has been 2 years in the planning. Things like this do not occur overnight. But what we need to do, I think, is look at the historical context for this. Back in the 1980s, there was a NATO war operation called Able Archer, which many people in then the Soviet Union believe was actually a precursor for a pre-strike capacity by the United States and NATO upon the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, which almost led to a nuclear confrontation, which is one of the sort of untold stories of the Cold War. So when these operations are put into place now, I think there's a greater degree of advanced warning effectively with Russia to make sure that doesn't happen. But there's no doubt about it that anything like this is going to be seen as a provocative act by Russia, just as it would be seen if it was being initiated by them effectively at this time. So the way in which we look at this, it's all well and good, but it clearly is potentially going to ratchet up the odds and the stakes with regard to the current situation between the West and the East.
Jeffrey, James there rather charitably described Vladimir Putin's foreign policy as assertive, which I thought was an excellent choice of adjective. Does, given as we were saying that this exercise has been 2 years in the planning, is this likely to concern Russia all that much, or is this the kind of thing about which Russia will make a great pretense of being outraged, alarmed, concerned, offended, shocked, etc.?
Listen, you can sit, and we've talked about Russia around this table for a fair amount. You can sit and rationally analyze Putin's motives and the futility of his strategy. You can say that all of this is going to get him nowhere, but it's just not a rational argument or discussion we're having now. This is about nationalism. It's about xenophobia. It's about pride. It's about restoring greater Russia. It's about the great old days of Catherine the Great, and you know, this is for Putin. He will watch this with interest, but Putin knows darn well that no one has any appetite for confrontation. And so these incursions that a few months ago into Finnish airspace by Russian jets, these kind of things are not happening by accident. He is being provocative. So I don't think it's fair to say that this is on its own provocative. This is a response to provocation, pardon me, there's that word. And there is a kind of, I guess you could call it armed deterrence. This is saying to him, look, we got this. But the fact is, and he knows, there's just short of a Soviet tanks invading Hungary, you're just not going to see a kind of aggressive response from NATO. He knows that, and he's going to keep pushing that.
James, you've talked in this space before about how, on its own terms and from his perspective, Putin's assertive, as you put it, foreign policy has worked pretty well for him. Are we seeing a pattern, though, of him, and I guess is it being repeated in Syria, of him not confronting NATO directly, not, for example, invading Latvia, but nibbling at it around the edges, sort of stirring up trouble in Georgia and Ukraine, invading Syria, occasionally sort of flying around the edges of the airspace of NATO powers, just keeping NATO on its toes?
Yeah, and we can add the UK airspace to that. Let's be
honest
about
it. Indeed so, yeah.
We haven't got to go as far as Central Eastern Europe for this. There's no doubt about it that what Putin is doing is deliberately trying to keep the West on edge. And he's doing a damn good job about it. There's very little pushback, as you rightly point out. No one is suggesting, despite whatever is coming out of NATO headquarters, that anyone wants to go to war with Russia. Putin knows this. Putin knows there's no political ambition for this. You know, we can say what we like about the NATO exercises which are taking place at the moment, but NATO is not just a military exercise and a military operation, it's a political entity as well. And where does the political heart of NATO lie? Lies in the Oval Office. And at the moment, there is absolutely no appetite, effectively, to engage with Russia. And why would there be at this point? Because there's no national interest at stake with regard to this. America's about to enter into an election cycle, as it always seems to be. So any provocation from Russia is going to go pretty much unanswered, I'd suggest, over the next 18 months until we know who the next president of the United States is, whoever she may be.
I, for one, was tickled by one training scenario that this exercise will involve, Jeffrey, which I'll put to you, which sees a United Nations Security Council resolution authorizing NATO action to protect a threatened state.
Right.
Which the punchline is inbuilt there, obviously that Russia would not veto this. The question being, does NATO realistically have a potential adversary that isn't Russia?
It's an interesting question. I mean, China's pretty far away to be a NATO adversary. And so you know, I guess, no, I mean, I think NATO's adversaries are actually, you know, Russia aside, are ISIS and the militants of the Middle East and the kind of the chaos that's descending on all the countries of the once celebrated Arab Spring. I think those are a bigger threat and, frankly, a more existential threat than Russia, although Russia has to be addressed contained. I think with Putin, you're seeing this kind of assertiveness that knows there's a line. And that's why, listen, it's no accident he invaded Ukraine and not Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. Because Ukraine is strategically, it's not part of NATO. Exactly. And it's not, as much as Western leaders bemoaned what was happening, they weren't going to do anything about it.
And James, yeah. What the final thought from you on that? I mean, does NATO actually really have a role other than to defend Europe from Russia? And how serious to you does it appear to be about doing that?
Well, this is the point. I mean, it's all well and good to, from a Western perspective, to sit here and look at what Putin is doing and bemoan that. But of course, he will look from the Kremlin westward and look at NATO and say, well, what was NATO created for? NATO was created solely to act as a block upon the Warsaw Pact operated out of Moscow, effectively. So it sees a Cold War relic, which is increasingly belligerent in its point of view, pushing westward and trying to impose upon what it sees as the Russian sphere of influence. So whilst one doesn't necessarily agree with what Putin's doing, one can understand why it is that NATO would be seen as being an aggressive force from their standpoint and why he's reacting so viscerally against it.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jeffrey Kaufman and James Boyce. Coming up next, some more bright ideas for tackling Islamic extremism.
It's out. The new November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, and it delivers a dynamic lineup of reports from around the globe and a special focus on the world of design. Here's what our editors have found for you this month.
In the design section, we head to an under-the-radar town in southern Spain and meet the secretive producers making leatherware for Europe's best brands.
In the edit section, we're directed to a Franconia restaurant in Berlin for filmmaker Wim Wenders' last meal.
Our November issue also includes our special Bavaria survey and a visit to a unique brewery where you can feel the Forscht. Get your copy today.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Boyce and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, over the last few weeks, the news agenda has been rightly consumed by the hundreds of thousands of people attempting to flee the Middle East for Europe. However, rather smaller but arguably just as challenging numbers continue to travel in the opposite direction. Here in the UK, the government has announced yet another series of proposals for deterring or discouraging homegrown jihadis, including extending already extant powers for concerned parents to request request the cancellation of their children's passports. James, first of all, the main thrust of the latest new proposals, and there does seem to be a new batch of these unveiled every week, is to confront what's called entryism, mm-hmm. or infiltration of public institutions, the NHS, schools, et cetera, et cetera. How does one successfully do that without getting, a bit McCarthyist?
You know, it's funny. I was reading the report on this, and the Muslim Council of Britain are using that exact expression, McCarthyism. I do wonder how many of them actually appreciate exactly what McCarthy was all about. Quite honest, I doubt many of them are historians of 1950s United States history. Quite frankly, it is an expression which is very, very easy to band around, and perhaps is misunderstood. I think what we need to recognise, whether we like it or not, is that the Home Secretary's job is to protect the realm, effectively. And she, in this case, Theresa May, will be acting upon the direct instruction of the Prime Minister, who's going to receive intelligence reports from the JIS, MI5, MI6, etc., etc. So whether one likes it or not, I think there is a requirement to address a developing intelligence-led issue here, which I recognise that some people might have civil rights issues with, no doubt about it. But unfortunately, the government's main response is to protect the realm, and if it sees the need to do that, then I guess it will take a series of steps, which we'll see as incremental, to do so in defence of the national interest.
Geoffrey, this has also been a problem which has exercised our own home countries, and our governments of both have not always responded with the greatest of tact, as you were suggesting earlier. When governments start doing this, especially in the public announcements they make, how much of it is wanting to appear to be doing something rather than actually doing something?
Oh, well, that's a philosophical question about any government action. But in this case, you know, I think James is right. They have to do something. I mean, these are real people going to fight for these horrific causes and in the Middle East, and adding further to the destabilization and potentially bringing it back or sending it back here. It has to be addressed. You know, the challenge is exactly as you began this conversation: how do you do it without creating a McCarthyite culture? How do you do it without branding every Muslim young man and woman as a potential terrorist? And that is a really it is a fine line to walk, but it is also one that comes down to the how do you secure your borders? How do you make people feel after 7/11 here? Or 7/7, is it? Pardon me. Oh, gosh, got me there. After 7/7 here, you know, it became a homeland threat. These are not abstract concepts. So it is true that something has to be done. You know, I think what worries me about this issue is that while there are some very notable voices in the Muslim community speaking against this, and it would be unfair to suggest that there aren't, there doesn't appear to be a cohesive wave of repulsion about this within the community. That there is mostly it is silence and some very eloquent people speaking. And I think that the ownership of this issue needs to be taken by these communities to say, this is not acceptable behavior. And, you know, mosques that are preaching this need to be closed down. And there seems to be a culture of fear or disengagement or apathy. I wouldn't claim to be an expert. But these communities need to take ownership. They need to aggressively root out this kind of talk. It's fine to live in a multicultural nation, but it's not fine if part of your community is seeding hate.
James, final thought on this one. How hard is it to do and to take those kind of steps without playing exactly into the victim/outlaw mentality that the extremists thrive on?
It's very difficult. Let's be honest about it. I mean, just the way, I mean, with respect, the way that your questions have been phrased, the way in which it's being reported in the media, it makes it very, very difficult to try and take an approach against this and to support in any way what Theresa May is doing from an ideological standpoint. But I think I'm very pleased that Geoffrey's on the side with this, the idea that we've got to do something. And if you're not seen to be doing something, it's problematic. And if anything were to occur, the government would be held accountable for it. I think it's remarkable that Theresa May is still in a position. You think about what a deadly poison chalice the Home Office is for most politicians. The fact that she's still there and is still seen to be a leading contender potentially for the Prime Ministership once David Cameron steps down, I think is testament to what a... an unrecognised job she's doing, perhaps at the Home Office.
Well, finally tonight, we'll stay in Britain, which is preparing for one of the more daunting diplomatic challenges available this week, and that's a state visit by the President of China. This is an honour the UK has successfully dodged since 2005, when Hu Jintao undertook a brief tour to a chorus of protests from pro-Tibet and pro-human rights campaigners. Xi Jinping will doubtless have to endure similar, as well as an overnight stay at Buckingham Palace, an address to Parliament, and a visit to Manchester, among other enchantments. Geoffrey, there is a question of balance always with diplomatic visits. It seems more precarious than most with China, which obviously is a hugely important country whose president is doubtless due all the proper protocols and courtesies. But how do you balance that with the fact that the regime he leads is not really terrifically pleasant?
Well, and this is it. You know, you can't. You've got to keep your friends close and your enemies closer, and it's important that the Chinese aren't enemies, but there are fundamental values that differences between the governments of the UK and China. I'm frankly horrified by the plans for this visit. 121-gun salute. He's going to go up the Mall to Buckingham Palace in a carriage. I mean, this is validation of his regime, and this effectively says to the people of China, look, you know, the beacon of democracy, you know, the Queen's own backyard is greeting me like a statesman and a hero. How dare you question my authority back home? I think it's nauseating. There are ways to do this without being quite so grand. A few less guns than 121 would be fine.
James, this, of course, follows up the Chancellor George Osborne's visit to China and his very obvious enthusiasm for China and obvious enthusiasm for Britain's deepening relationship with China. Has the British government made a possibly cynical but nonetheless realistic calculation that, frankly, China doesn't really care what Britain thinks about anything, so you might as well attempt to profit from the relationship?
Let's be very honest about this. We've seen governments in the West try to tie its trade policy with China to improvements in, for example, China's human rights operations for decades now. I mean, going back at least as far as Bill Clinton in the early 90s. And what happens? Nothing. China can quite happily sit there and go, oh, it's kind of interesting. Thank you very much. We'll keep doing exactly what we want to do.
We appreciate your input.
It's exactly. It's very interesting. We'll file that away, quite frankly, and do nothing about it. So I think that what you've seen, both in Washington and in London, is a pragmatic response to that, which is to say, you know what? Let's stop trying to change the politics over there and actually introduce market reform. And I think you've actually seen quite a positive, understated approach by the West to try to get increasing market reform into China so that you're getting increasing middle class. And the hope in the West is that what you'll see is with that increasing market reform, that increasing middle class, that those millions of people now entering in that area will now start calling for political reform. It's the exact opposite of what happened, for example, with Russia. And it's a long game. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. It's not a game which is going to show developments and fruition anytime in the next year or two. But I think that the hope from the West is that by introducing market reform, you're going to get a sense of eventual political reform in China.
Geoffrey, do you think there is anything to that, and maybe anything to the idea that China might be more encouraged by a few carriage rides and overnight stays in various palaces than by being treated as some kind of pariah?
Absolutely. But I think there is a way to do this without doing it quite so grandly and generously. And I think one of the things that comes into this equation is also, I think it's very worrisome. The UK is trying to build a nuclear plant with Chinese money and Chinese investment. And you know, this is a country that has, that sabotages our internet, that spies on us in all sorts of nefarious ways. And here is the UK saying, basically, here are keys to a nuclear power plant. Thank you very much for putting money into our infrastructure. I get why it's being done, and I understand it. I think it's a very, very dangerous way for the UK to be financing nuclear power.
Final thought on that from you, James. Before inviting the Chinese to participate in funding and building infrastructure projects, especially nuclear power stations, should the United Kingdom be asking the always valuable question, what could possibly go wrong?
Well, you'd hope. But it's also important to recognise that Washington isn't too far behind on this. The same leader who's going to be in London was recently in Washington, D.C. BBC and was feted by the White House. We're at a point where the West cannot afford to deal on an ongoing basis with China on this in this regard. So, you know, we cannot afford not to engage with China. And unfortunately, sometimes that means giving them a 121-gun salute.
We will have to leave it there on that clamorous note. James Boyes and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us. That is all for today's Midori House, which was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Henry Rees Sheridan and Carla Strunk. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Chris Lord is keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. He's live from our Istanbul bureau. At 1900 hours, you can hear The Culture Show with Robert Bound at 2200 The Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 London time. For this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.